Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 132, everybody. Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel with you here. Andrew, an indulgent one. This is, isn't it, really?
Just a bit.
Because we're talking about our jobs, basically. We're talking about press launches and hopefully just kind of lifting the lid a little bit on that because, you know, I think people are sort of interested to know how it all works.
Yeah, I mean, and if, dear listeners, you find this just too self-indulgent for words, do tell us. We have this sort of strange, slightly narcissistic hope that you might find what follows interesting. You might not, but yeah, we're just going to look into how we do our job. Well, yeah, a component of our jobs. You know, it's not all flying around the world driving nice cars at all, but there is certainly an element of that, and it's the element that you probably see most of. We just thought it hopefully might be interesting to sort of lift the lid on it a bit and just to sort of discuss, you know, what's important to us about going on a press launch. And of course it's all about staying in the nicest possible hotels and you know, free gifts in rooms and first class travel everywhere. Or maybe not.
And that's how they get five stars, isn't it?
Of course, yeah.
I mean, 5-star hotel, 5-star review.
Yeah, I think we mark ours out of 10, though, so, yeah.
Oh, that's true. okay, well, we've got a couple of things I want to discuss beforehand. The first of which is the final episode in season one of Last Blast.
Yeah.
Perfect guest, Ian Callum, superstar car designer. And actually, it probably feels a bit too early to say this while he's still working, but if he's not the UK's preeminent car designer, I don't know who is.
I would think, and I don't know whether you ask Ian this question, I would think he would say Malcolm Sayer, who's another Jaguar designer who designed the C-Type, the D-Type, the E-Type. But actually, Sayer was predominantly an aerodynamicist. Whose job it was actually just to design road cars. Yeah, I mean, it's hard to think of anybody who's got a clear claim ahead of Ian. I mean, you know, his influence we have seen in so many cars over such a long period of time. It's absolutely amazing, his portfolio of stuff.
Yeah, it really is. So it was fascinating to talk to him. And this is the first Last Blast that I've done. You've done all the others so far.
Yep.
But I did this one. And now I must confess, I had to do this one remotely because I was extremely poorly on the day of the interview. I was supposed to go into his place in Warwickshire, to Callum, to interview him face to face. And I woke up feeling dreadful. And actually, I had my head in the toilet bowl.
Nice.
5 minutes before our Zoom call was due to
Thanks
start.
Thanks for sharing.
And as, yeah, well, a pleasure. And I was kneeling on the bathroom floor, I was thinking, well, it's off. It's just not, I'm going to have to cancel. But you know what it's like after the episode? You suddenly feel a bit better, don't you? And so I thought, oh, I could do it. I'll just do it. I'll just get on with it. And because he's kind and generous, he just made it very, very straightforward. He did all the heavy lifting. He did all the hard work. And hopefully it's a decent interview. But I just want to play 90 seconds of it now. And this is Ian talking about designing the DB7.
I have to mention the DB7. It happened after Ford, but just after Ford, I went to TWR. And I was very, very fortunate that the first car that I worked on became the DB7. You know, I had a rather controversial start. It was going to be a Jaguar. Jaguar wasn't interested. And so we changed it all. And contrary to popular belief, we didn't just use the same car. We turned it into an Aston. And that really was my first endeavour as a full car designer. Believe it or not, I'd never really done a full car before then. I didn't tell Tom this until after we finished it. He was rather horrified. But so the DB7 to me was a calling card for the rest of my life, really. And I'm still kind of known for it now. And I look at him in the street and I think, yeah, it's quite a pretty car. And the significant thing about it was that two things. One is I did it almost entirely my own. I had to become very self-critical. And it's a good discipline as a designer. I taught my teams to do this. So you look at it with absolute scrutiny as if someone else had done it. You had to. You couldn't kid yourself. It was good when it wasn't. But I had a lovely moment with the 7. When we finished them and I got a prototype or an early production one to drive, I took it back up to Dumfries in Scotland. And, I always dreamt I would drive back into that town, the car I designed. I mean, that's a big deal for a young man.
The Last Blast podcast is sponsored by Footman James, a car insurance company unlike any other. Footman James exists right at the heart of the car enthusiast scene in the UK, holding regular car meets, publishing reports into the health of the classic car scene in this country, and yes, sponsoring the best car podcast out there. Thank you, Footman James. To find out more, visit footmanjames.co.uk. One of the questions I asked him a bit later on was, how is it that you have been able to have this glittering career? You've got this incredible portfolio that 99% of car designers would kill to have. And of course, because he's modest, he just goes, good luck. It was all good luck. And of course, it wasn't. He took a gamble in leaving Ford to go and work with Tom Walkinshaw. But that gamble gave him the opportunity to design the DB7. And that was the thing that elevated him. And of course, he followed it up with the Vanquish, with the DB9. But it was that gamble that he took that really made his career. So it wasn't good luck at all.
He was brave, wasn't he? Fortune favours the brave, and in his case, deservedly so. You just think about how many car designs the DB7 has influenced. How many cars would look different, look worse, just how much poorer the world of late 20th and early 21st century automotive design would be without Ian's input.
And it's not just the glossy stuff, is it? It's saloons and SUVs,
all sorts of stuff.
So my Last Blast interview with Ian Callum is available now for TI subscribers on the app, on the website, the-intercooler.com. And they're all there, all six episodes of season one. So if you haven't subscribed yet, you could start your 1 month free trial now and rattle through all of them if you wanted to.
And we are already amassing guests for season two. We haven't yet decided when season two is going to go out, but we know from the response we've had that season one has been immensely popular. We're quite proud of it. I think we have found a format which works. So long as we continue to get great guests, and we kind of hope that it'll get easier because we'll be able to say, well, Ian Callum's been on, and Adrian Newey's been on, and Chris Hoy's been on, and so on and so forth. But they're like, oh, well, maybe I'll come on too. So it's something we plan on keeping going with.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely it is. Okay, so before we talk about press launches, I've been driving a couple of cars and I want to just sort of trot through them quickly. The first is the Theon Design 964 restoration, which I drove a few weeks ago, and it's I've written about it for the Intercooler app and website. It went live today, that story. And it's a very interesting car. They're an Oxfordshire company, relatively new. I think this is only the fourth or fifth car, the one that I drove, the fourth or fifth car that they've actually produced for a customer. It does seem like it's every week, doesn't it, that a new air-cooled 911.
Another resto modded. Yeah.
Yeah, they just come up all the time, it seems. So it's not exactly original, but this one's nicely done. You know, it looks fantastic. It does look rather a lot like another resto modded 911, and you won't have to think too hard about which one that is. But it's a fantastic looking car. It's done to a good standard.
It's a bit cheaper than the other one as well, isn't it?
It is a bit cheaper than the other one. I suspect it's a bit underpriced. It's 380,000 basic before the donor car, before local taxes, before any options. And it seems bananas, doesn't it? I checked because I had to remind myself. Currently, well, maybe apart from the Icona models. So what's that, SP3?
Daytona? Yeah. Yeah. It's most expensive. It's more expensive than any Ferrari you can buy.
Apart from that one, yeah.
Do you know what we should do? You know, because because I think almost everybody uses 964s as their sort of donor cars for these things, don't they?
Yeah.
Because they're reasonably plentiful. They're not that expensive to buy relative to, you know, more desirable air-cooled 911s, and they're among the best built. You know, they're fully galvanized, so they haven't rotted away. And it's just the kind of obvious choice, isn't it? We ought to just go and drive a standard 964 Carrera 2 in really nice condition, just to see where the bar is. Because I reckon it's been so long since I've been in one of those. It's been so long since I've been, and I reckon you get it and you just think, wow, this is fantastic.
Mm.
I reckon you'd really, really like it.
Yeah, I'd like to drive one. I've driven a 964 briefly, but not as much as I'd like. But yeah, it's a good idea. The trouble with these resto mods is that when they're built in very low volumes and there's no scale, and you want to do it to a high standard and it's hand-built using top-notch components, the price of it all just spirals so quickly.
And it's fine because they sort of go beyond, you know, being a car, don't they? And they become a statement, or they become a bit of artwork, or whatever. And that, I guess, is, you know, that and the exclusivity is where the, if you want to call it as such, the value lies. But as a thing to drive, I haven't driven this Theon, I'm sure it's lovely, but it's probably not 10 times as good as a 964, is it?
Probably not. It's always diminishing returns, isn't it, as cars become more expensive. And it's, so you'd have to be buying into the look. And I guess to some extent,
we should do a story which goes, look, this is the car that everyone turns to when they want to rest a modern 911. Why? And just how good is it before you've even touched it?
It'd also be
fantastic.
There are some people who are suggesting that all 964s are being turned into resto modded 911s. I think Porsche built...
You're going to run out of 964s.
I think Porsche built something like 60,000 in all. Just over half of those were coupes. You know, I think Singer.
And how many of those are rear drives? I guess the majority would be rear drives, I guess.
I think so. I mean, the four-wheel drive came first, didn't it? So I'd have to check. But the point is, there are plenty out there. I'm sure there are plenty of them out there. But yeah, it'd be a fun thing to do. I just worry that, you know, building five or six cars a year starting with a starting price of 380,000. I think Theon Design have got a lot of work to do. They need to get to a point where they can start charging more, because this game is just stupidly expensive, and it's not sustainable until you're building a certain number of cars and you're charging a certain amount. But anyway, it's all in the story. It's live on the Intercooler app and website now, to go and check it out if you want to know more about the Theon Porsche.
If I was very rich, I'd just start stockpiling 964 Carrera 2s with decent shells. If you think about it, you know, Mark II Escort prices, you know, just find a basic stock Mark II Escort, and it's worth tens of thousands of pounds because they've all been turned into rally cars.
And people always Dodge said, didn't they, why didn't we... That's right, and about the Escorts, people said, why didn't someone tell me and I would have stashed them away? So you're right, maybe we need to get ahead of the curve, and maybe the 964 is the next one.
And, you know, try and find... You know, I'm not joking. The number of Dodge Chargers, 440RT Dodge Chargers that got Muller making the Dukes of Hazzard series was so great that, you know, that's actually had a material effect on the number of those that remain. So yeah, maybe that's what we should do. Maybe we should be we should be in the stockpiling 964 business.
Sadly, neither of us is rich.
No,
you did say that at the start, didn't you? Okay.
Yes.
Well, not yet. Let me talk about another car that I've been driving recently. Very different sort of car. You came in it with me the other day, Andrew. It's bright, greeny yellow. It's the Genesis GV60. This was the dual motor one with 400 and something horsepower. Top of the line model. And it's the Genesis equivalent of the Kia EV6 or the Hyundai Ioniq 5.
Yeah.
Basic price, £65,000. With options, this car, £75,000.
I don't know. It's just too much money. I mean, I went in it with you. I didn't drive it, but it seemed, you know, a nice enough thing, despite the fact that the claim range and the actual range seem to be so wildly
quite different.
We left our food issue. You didn't even know if you're going to get home. And you know, it's who's going to? I mean, maybe I'm wrong, but maybe that's just what people do. Maybe people are that rich that, you know, you can buy a, you know, a well-equipped but in otherwise, you know, fluently executed but in no way remarkable electric car and think, you know, I'm going to spend the same money on this as I might a 4-litre Porsche Cayman, a Cayman GTS. It's that money, isn't it?
And also, no one knows what Genesis is here in the UK. It's new. It's brand new here. It doesn't have a lot of currency, does it?
Everyone has to start somewhere and you can't blame them for being new. But yep. I mean, that's the problem with these electric cars. You know, I think, you know, an EV6 or an Ioniq 5, I think, you know, for what they do, in my view, they're the best that you can get. You know, I think they're massively better than anything that I've driven that rivals them from the Volkswagen group. But they're just so much money, aren't they?
It's unbelievable.
It is unbelievable, and I guess they have to be, because maybe that's, you know, the manufacturers have to recoup the enormous cost of developing the entirely new platforms that these things require, and maybe when they become more popular and there are many more of them, the prices will come down and it'll just seem more normal. But the idea of a, what is it? It's a 4-stroke, 5-speed, mid-sized crossover SUV, yeah? To me, that's a 30 grand car. It's not a £75,000 car.
It is staggering. I just had to mention it because it's a nice enough thing to drive. The low-speed ride is not brilliant. The interior is, I mean, it's got a few sort of design flourishes, but I don't think it's incredible. I don't think it's really notable. But it's just the price of these things. I really can't get my head around it. And it's, you know, it's got, I'm looking at it now, it's got almost 500 horsepower, so it's got some go.
But it needs that, doesn't it? Because it's so heavy.
It's because it's so heavy. I got into it, and it was showing 90% charge, and it reckoned it would do 190 miles, which is a good 80 short of, more than that, actually. It's almost, it's 100 short of the claimed combined range. So, I don't know. It's a nice thing to drive, nice enough thing to drive, but it's so much money, and I'm just not convinced by its utility. So, interesting
thing. Time to move on.
Let's move it on. So, press launches.
Press launches.
Yeah, I've been on a bit of a journey with press launches. I think I got to a point where I was doing so many of them that I just ran out of patience with them, and I began to find them really frustrating. I'm sure you've been there with them.
Yeah, I guess where we have to be careful is, you know, there's the outward face of the press launch is we're usually in a place where the weather is good, on roads that look nice, and they tend to put us up in quite nice hotels. And, you know, if you are working in an office, or doing any number of jobs, the sort of jobs that most people do, you know, we are going to seriously struggle to get anyone to feel sorry for us over the course of the next half an hour that we talk about this. And it's not really our purpose in talking about these things. Really, what I want to talk about is those launches which help us do our jobs better and produce a better product as a result, which, you know, hopefully is important to people who consume that product, because, you know, we like to think ourselves as, you know, reasonably professional motoring journalists who take pride in what we do. And if, for instance, you know, somebody decides to launch a car at a hotel in the middle of an enormous sprawling city because it's a posh hotel and it somehow fits with their brand, but what that actually means is, you know, maybe you've got 3 hours driving the car and you have to spend an hour at the beginning, an hour at the end, getting in and out of that city, then that's, you know, to us, that's just really, really frustrating. You know, if you have a press launch, and I've been on one of these, where the route, and, you know, when we go on press launches, they always have the sort of the route that they would like you to stick to. You don't always do it, but sometimes you do if it looks good or if time is very short or whatever. And the route for this was out of one town, down a dual carriageway, to a roundabout at the other end of the dual carriageway, turn around and come straight back again. And you are meant to somehow be able to write a comprehensive evaluation of the car on the back of that. It's a nonsense. But that's, you know, sometimes that's what happens. And yeah, it's, you know, to me, the press launches that annoy me most are those where there's just needless amounts of messing about on transfer coaches, yeah, or just waiting around, and all that is time you could be, you know, really, I only want to do two things at a press launch. I want to talk to engineers and I want to drive the car. Don't really want to do anything else. And you have these press conferences where they just read the press pack to you. I've already got the press pack. I can read it myself, thanks.
Yeah.
You know, tell us something I don't already know. So I'm going to go off on one in a minute.
Okay. Shall I jump in? Sorry.
Yeah, jump, let's, please. Shut
just
me
to
up.
Sort of set the scene a little bit. What's the glitziest press launch you've been on?
The glitzy? Well, it depends how you measure it. Yeah. I did once go on a MyBack launch somewhere in the Middle East where I had... I had two butlers. I had a day butler and a night butler. And they were posted outside my room. And apart from saying hello to them as I went in and out of that room, that was the only contact I had. And I think they must be really disappointed because they were there literally to do, you know, whatever I wanted. I can't even imagine what that might have been. I went on one in California at a place called Pelican Hill where I had... My hotel room had four bedrooms and two garages. I thought that was quite impressive.
What?
Yeah.
Bloody hell.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And
all sorts.
You've done the private jet thing from Farnborough or the Harris Terminal?
Well, I mean, we do actually do quite a lot of that. But sometimes, very rarely, you get on what people think of private jets is like, where basically you walk into it and it's got four seats and they're all thrones. But actually, there are lots of private jets which are basically economy class little airliners. And car manufacturers charter them because it's cheaper than to do it that way than to pay airlines to fly us about. And more flexible because it takes off when you want it to, goes exactly where you want it to, and leaves when you want it to. And if journalists, and if they're, you know, if a journalist is late, if they're sufficiently important, and sadly some of them are, they'll just delay the plane. So it's done for those reasons. It's very, very rare. But, I mean, it has happened. I can remember the first launch I ever went on, which is the Alpha 164. And we drove down through France and ended up Bordeaux way, I think. I got caught for speeding. Alfa Romeo paid the fine. Couldn't believe that. It was one of those 900 franc fines. That would never happen these days. And then the idea was is that I think one group drove the cars out and another group drove the cars back, so we were flown home. And so we went to Bordeaux Airport and got on a little PJ. And I can remember finding under my seat, instead of a life jacket, a little drinks cabinet, and thinking, well, these guys got their priorities right. And I was I 23 at the time, and just thinking, oh, my God. This is the world I have landed in. Like all my Christmases come at once. And of course, 99.9% of them aren't like that. But it was a bit of an eye opener.
Mm. So, yeah, I've done some glitzy ones. You know, We've done front of the plane into the Middle East, Oman, I think it was, and then to the Ritz-Carlton or some swanky hotel. And then my room is a standalone villa with its own, in its own compound with a pool. And, you know, I don't know. It sounds all whizzy, but I'm actually just so unmoved by that stuff now. I just don't care. I just want a reasonably comfortable room.
The thing is,
good roads, plenty of time in the car. I don't want to be in the air for hours. I don't want to be hanging around for hours. I don't want a long transfer, you know?
No, you see, I disagree with you with being in the air for hours. I love being, it's one of the reasons I do the long distance ones. Because I just like 12 hours at 40,000 feet where no one can get at you, because it's just so efficient for me. It's just the amount of work you can get done. And also because, you know, I am an absolute sucker for displacement activities. You know, and I can't just, you know, be looking through the classifieds, you know, wandering around piston heads or whatever. Really, all because I'm not very good at, you know, I get very bored watching movies, and there's really very little else you can do. So it kind of forces me to work. So, I don't mind that. What I hate are the little European ones where, you know, for me, it's 2 hours to the airport, fair enough. And then you're in the long-term car park, and then you're ready for the long-term. But all the stuff that you do, which everybody does when they go on holiday, but instead of going on holiday and at least being away from it for a week somewhere nice and sunny, which is what most people do when they go and lie on a beach or whatever, you know, we do all that. We then drive a car, and then the following day we do it all over again to come back. And, you know, and if you look at the component, you know, it's quite often you'll take, well, most car lots today, you take 2 days of your life and you drive a car in those 2 days, particularly if you're sharing it with somebody else, which is also usually what happens. You'll drive the car. You might get 3 hours of actual driving the car yourself, and it's taken 2 days of your life to drive a car for 3 hours. And I just think there's got to be a better way.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what does a good press launch look like? I mean, I think one of the ones that really stands out for me, and because it was so simple, it was when the current Mazda MX-5 was new and it had just arrived in the UK. They flew a bunch of us, Ryanair or EasyJet, from one of the London airports up to Inverness. The cars were waiting there for us. And the absolute masterstroke of this one was that somehow I got lucky and landed a car to myself.
Yeah.
And then the route went up to a good chunk of the North Coast 500. So the country's best roads. This was Ash's time. And so I had TMS on by myself, just bombing along, just thinking,
that's Test Match Special to anybody who are cricket fans.
And it was just fantastic. And then, you know, we spent almost all day in the car, got home. I think there was a relaxed, low-key dinner, a little bit more time in the car the next day, and then home.
Okay.
And that
so the worst launch I've ever been in. Okay, yeah. So can I give you the worst one? Because it also happens to be an MX-5 launch.
Oh, I think you've mentioned this one before. This is the one where you're in the air for longer than you were on the ground. Is that right? Or a multiple?
Just a bit. So this was the third generation MX-5, which they decided to launch in Hawaii. I know no one's feeling sorry for me. And they launched it in Hawaii because it was exactly halfway between their two biggest markets, which are Japan and North America. Mm. So I will cut this very short. But we flew to LA. We then flew to Honolulu. We then flew to another island where the launch was taking place. We had the car for an hour and a half. But we had to divide it between myself and the person I was sharing it with. The island we were on was so choked with traffic, most of whom appeared to be police cars. We eventually found one road on which the entire launch just drove up and down, because it was the only road on the island worth driving up and down. Anyway, so the long and the short it was, I travelled for 44 hours to drive a car for 45 minutes on a rubbish road.
Yeah, that's it. So a minute. So 1-to-1.
1 hour per travel per minute of actually doing the job.
Yeah, that's
bananas.
And
of course, you know, I went to Hawaii, and, you know, and it was amazing. And the hotel was, I can remember, people don't believe me when I say this, but the swimming pool had fish in it, big fish. All that was, you know, amazing and incredible. But it's not actually what I went there to do.
Well, this is
I went there to drive a car.
This is why this sounds like a grumble, because actually, what we want is to have an opportunity to properly assess the car that we're there to drive.
That's
we
it.
Want access to engineers, maybe designers, maybe executives, but ideally the engineers responsible for the car.
Yeah.
We want plenty of seat time. We want great roads. Because that's how you get to properly understand the car that you're driving. And that's how you get to produce your best work. And that's better for everyone reading it. But it's so rare. It's so rare that the conditions are right for us to be able to do the best job that we possibly can, because the manufacturers have their own priorities, their own things that they want to, their own boxes that they want to tick. And it does seem to be the case that, I think maybe not so much anymore, but they want to go to a hotel that no other manufacturer has used. They want to go to, that hotel has to be particularly swanky. It has to be, I don't know what it is that they want. They want to somehow reflect what they consider to be their brand or the brand of the particular car, forgetting entirely that none of that stuff is interesting to any of us. If it means we're driving on bad roads, if it means we have very little seat time.
It's not like it's like a romantic weekend away.
No.
Excuse me, you're not there with your other half. You're there to work. You're there to do a job. You know, to me, what is important about a hotel is it has a comfortable bed, air conditioning, and Wi-Fi that works. That's it.
Yeah.
And really, you know, I need to be able to get a decent night's sleep because, you know, I'll probably need to drive a car quite fast in the morning. Beyond that, you know, and yeah, I mean, we can bang on about it, but it's... you know, and I know that we're spoiled, and I know we're lucky, and I know that we're privileged. But the only time that I find car launches frustrating is when, you know, what they have done to introduce you to their car is actually getting in the way of you finding out about that car. And sometimes it becomes completely counterproductive because, you know, if you are in a launch where there's very little seat time, and there aren't any engineers around, and the route is very restricted, and it's all smoother, you just start thinking, well, what don't they want you to know?
Yeah.
What are they trying to... I mean, obviously, any car manufacturer is going to choose a launch venue and a launch event which suits the car they're trying to launch. I mean, that's natural and understandable and fine. But if they actually go so far as to limit your exposure to the car, how you can drive it, where you can drive it, you just start to think, well, you know, they don't actually want you to get underneath the skin of this car, and there therefore must be a reason for that. And then I start getting very suspicious, and then I go really, really looking for everything. So yeah, it can backfire.
I noticed that my attitude towards changes and towards launches and how I prefer them to be configured depended slightly on my employment situation. If I was on staff on a car magazine, I didn't mind if we got to the airport at midday and flew at 2 and arrived and had a little bit of time in the car and then a dinner. And then we took our time the next day and didn't arrive back until a bit late because you're getting paid a certain amount anyway. You're on someone else's clock, you know, and if there's no opportunity to sit down and write, so be it. I'll do it when I get into the office. You know, and that's all fair enough. But when you work for yourself, when you're freelance, and time literally is money, those faffy launches where you're hanging around, where it's a late start, where it's, you know, where there's a long bus transfer where you can't really get much done, they become increasingly frustrating, don't they?
And don't you just appreciate those where they have quite clearly, where the manufacturers quite clearly thought, well, okay, we're inviting these journalists out to drive these cars. How can we help them do their job? What is going to be important to them? And you know, that to me is, you know, there are certain manufacturers who appear not to think about that at all. They just think, well, we want to introduce this car in a certain way. And as you say, we want to stay in this hotel and we'll do everything for our own convenience and the way we want it to be. And, you know, they should just feel lucky to be invited. And so, you know, they get to come along and we won't pay any attention to what they really need to do because it just doesn't matter. Mm. But sometimes, you know, you get to a launch and you just know that they've really, really thought because, I mean, so an example was the Aston Martin DB9 launch, which is going back to, whatever we're talking about, 2003, something like that. The hotel was on the route. Mm. You literally, and the route was like the Col de Vence, the south of France. And you literally just literally drove out of the hotel, turned left, amazing road.
Perfect. Yeah? Yeah.
So no faffing about. And they had, you know, because they knew it was a good car and because, you know, they really wanted to bang the drum, they had all the executives and the designers and the engineers that were there. And, you know, it was south of France, so it didn't take very long to get there. And the whole thing just, it was just set up for the people that they were inviting, journalists. And, you know, okay, I'm sure that I can't even remember the hotel. I'm sure it's perfectly nice, but that's not what you remember. What I remember was appreciating so much that somebody had thought about how I was going to do my job. And, you know, and that's what you need. You don't need five-star restaurants, five-star hotels. You know, you need designers, engineers, executives, and a decent opportunity to drive the car. And that is it.
What do you make of the five-course fine dining meal in the evening that takes 3 hours?
I just much rather not have it.
Yeah.
We always say this, don't we, Dan? You and I, and you know, almost all the people, because we tend to hang out with similar like-minded individuals.
Yeah.
We'll always just go, can we not just go and find a little burger bar around the corner and you know, have a couple of beers, hang out with the locals, have steak free, and go to bed? That's what everybody I know actually wants to do. No, you've got to go and have the gastronomic tasting menu, and you've got to drink that wine with that course and that wine with that course, and you're sitting there just thinking, this is all time I could be writing or sleeping or doing something else. And sometimes you do find certain manufacturers who completely get this, and this is where we draw a distinction between car manufacturers who organise them, and then the sort of, you know, for instance, you know, if there's a German car manufacturer, you will be invited on the launch by the UK press office. And sometimes the UK press offices will go, well, you know, maybe if you're there for 2 nights, they'll say, well, you know, we have to go to the big dinner on the first night, but maybe we can sneak away on the second night. And then you'll just do that. And then you'll just go out somewhere local and get something simple and nice and a couple of beers. And it's just, that's all we want to do. But the problem is, you know, sort of, how would we describe ourselves? Sort of like hardcore motoring media. We're not the only people who get invited on these things. You know, they have, to invite the sort of the national press, they have to invite influencers, you know, these days. They have to invite lifestyle media. And, you know, lots of these people are much more interested in the side of the swimming pool than, you know, the dynamics of the car. And they don't want to drive the car very fast. They just want to go and, you know, soak up the luxury and feel, you know, appreciated and, you know, and everything. And all the stuff that you and I not only don't care about, but I actually find all that stuff gets in the way. And so, you know, maybe have a certain sympathy for the manufacturer, because they've got to have a launch which will somehow keep you and me happy, and also, you know, members of the lifestyle media. I mean, you hear stories, you know, and this has certainly happened, where people have been sent by their editors on car launches who don't know how to drive, literally don't have a driving license, because they come from some glossy magazine, and appears not to have occurred to anyone that driving the car might in some way be important. And because, you know, the people who read those magazines also buy cars, and they probably have massive circulations and everything else, you know, the poor PR teams have to keep them happy too. And so you have to have a launch in a hotel which, you know, has a spa and they can have endless treatments and, you know, this, that and the other, when you and I are just sitting there thinking, I want to drive the car. And of course, you know, what they don't do, they don't mix them up. So we very rarely find ourselves on the same rotation as them. So, you know, there is some flexibility to, you know, for us to be driving the cars when they're, you know, having their nails done or whatever, but nevertheless, you know, you do have these sort of one size fits all launches, which, you know, can be a bit frustrating.
That's right. And it's not just different media, but different territories, different nations. So some of us, particularly the UK, we and plenty of others, we want to drive the car, we want to spend time with the car and with the engineers, and that's what's important. But there are other nations whose journalists seem to expect different things of these launches, and they do want the pool and they do want the treatments and they do want the meal and the luxury. And so to some
extent, I quite like those things if I was on holiday. Why not? If, you know, but it's not what I'm there to do.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't understand. That's the disconnect. You know, you are there to do a job.
Hmm.
And if you take pride in your work, surely you want to do your job as well as you possibly can. And if you really think that doing your job as well as you possibly can is, you know, sitting on a lilo in a pool rather than out there driving the car, your priorities are very different to mine.
So one of my favourite ever launches, this goes back a few years, was the... So when the Range Rover Sport, the second generation Range Rover Sport was new, and Land Rover did the international media launch out of Cheltenham, hotel in Cheltenham. Right. And this was handy for me because I live in Bristol.
You live in Bristol.
So yeah. It's a 50-minute drive to the hotel, which is just fantastic. You know, we're so used to bombing along first thing in the morning, aren't we, to Heathrow or Gatwick or, heaven forbid, yeah, Luton or something. And so to be so close to home is brilliant. But the fantastic thing about this launch was that it was a two-day thing. And as Land Rover often do with their events, they put on a titanic route. I remember it went through South Wales into Mid Wales. I don't think we quite went to North Wales, but then we came back down into the Cotswolds and ended up at, it's Cotswold Airport, isn't it? Where we...
Oxford Airport, yeah.
Yeah, where we drove through a gutted, essentially, 747. And they'd, I don't know how they did it, but they built all these ramps going up into the fuselage and along. And you'd be at 45 degrees going through this fuselage. You know, that's, it doesn't really help you with your job. It's just a cool thing to get to do. But the thing about this launch was that there was so much time in the car. There was so much time on great roads. And helpfully, roads that I know really, really well from having driven on them for 10 years. In South Wales, yeah, in particular. Lots of different types of roads, you know, narrow tracks, good flowing A roads, tight twisty B roads, bit of sort of dual carriageway stuff. So it's, and some urban stuff as well. So it's a thorough assessment of the car. But they also put on, and I, to this day, I don't know where it was exactly, but it's somewhere in South or Mid Wales. We pulled off the road onto a gravel track into the forest. And we were stopped by someone in a high vis who said, "So we're now, you're now on a gravel track. This is a rally stage, actually. There are no speed limits. Enjoy." And so when do you ever hear that? So off we went, drive tearing down bit. This gravel rally stage as fast as we dared. That was absolutely fantastic. And so, yeah, there is something about the UK-based international media launch that I am.
Yeah,
all
but they don't
for.
Like doing it, do it? Because you know we are all very used to going over to to Europe or the US or wherever and driving on, you know, on the right hand side of the road. But it doesn't work the other way around.
Well, and it wouldn't because overseas journalists just don't do it.
No,
you know, unless you're from Oz or somewhere, you just don't do it.
No,
and
you know, as we all did when we first drove on what we call the wrong side of the road, it's quite intimidating, and that gets in the way you're doing your job too. So there are very few internationals that happen over here. They did have the GD3 RS International over here, but it was at Silverstone, and we weren't driving on the road. So you know, so that's why they did that.
What we're seeing a bit more of, and Porsche is a good example. And it doesn't happen all the time, it happens occasionally. But rather than do the international media launch, what they'll do is they'll get a car into the UK. It might be a left-hand drive car, that's fine. But they, and it might be, I don't know, an engineering car or something. But they'll borrow a car, and at the same time as the media launch, they'll just invite a handful of journalists to go and take it away for a day. And that means we well, have lots of time with the car. But it also means we can go where we want with it, within reason. And finding roads that we're familiar with, I'd rather drive a car on a road that I knew for 10 miles than one I didn't know for 30 or 40, probably.
Oh, completely, completely. Yeah, driving on roads that you know, but are also which are relevant to the majority of people who are going to read what you write, is such an important component of you know, going back to this business of, you know, doing your job well. And of course it's convenient if cars come to us or you don't have to go very far to drive them, and that's great. And, you know, and again, as freelancers, that is important because, you know, none of us gets paid very much money. You know, it's not as if you're ever going to become a rich person doing this. And, you know, if you can find a way of, you know, efficiently, I'm very lucky where I live, you know, I can be on a decent road 3 minutes from leaving my front door. And I have routes around here, which, you know, I can do a half hour route around here, which I will learn more about the car that I'm driving than I will, on a 2 day launch in, I don't know, Malaga or Barcelona or Munich or wherever we often end up. And so, yeah, and I appreciate that too, because again, it just allows me to do a better job. And if that allows me also to be more efficient and therefore I don't spend 2 days, you know, going to somewhere to drive a car, but I can do it in the morning or an afternoon, I get a better story and I get a day and a half where I can work on doing other things. And that's, you know, for me, it's important because, you know, this business doesn't pay, you know, massive amounts of money.
Mm.
God, am I saying, have we disappeared up our own fundaments yet? There was a film that was made years ago called When Rover Met BMW, and it was all about BMW buying Rover, and there was a component of it which was about the press launch of some new Rover, and they were interviewing journalists as they came off a plane, and the PRs were standing there, and I think it must have been a private plane, because one of the journalists complained about the quality of the wine that had been provided on the plane. I won't name him. Sadly, he's passed away, so I could name him, but that's not really the point. But I am just aware of just how, you know, lucky we are, and also how lucky we are perceived to be. And, you know, I hope that none of what we've said has descended into spoilt brattery. It may have done, and if it does, it's inadvertent, and I apologise. But it's hopefully just interesting to understand a little bit about what's important to us, about how we bring to you what we do, you know, most days of our life.
And the point is, we couldn't be further from that crowd who are complaining about the quality of the wine. We're worried about the quality of the roads and the seat time.
Yes.
But okay, there are two things that I want to address quickly. Is it conceivable that a fancy hotel, a private jet, a gift? Well, we haven't even spoken about gifts.
Gifts? Blags? Well, they don't happen anymore, do they?
The blag. They don't happen anymore. But is it conceivable that all of that stuff possibly sways any journalist into writing a more positive review, because people will assume that's the whole point of it all?
Absolutely, it must, because they wouldn't do it if it didn't.
Yeah.
It has to. Whether it would sway you or me, I would sincerely, profoundly hope not, and I believe it doesn't. But given that you can't have two identical experiences where you change one component and then read what you write as a result, I don't know. Okay, what does make a difference is if a manufacturer has actually gone to the effort of allowing you to really experience the car, to really get under its skin, you are going to write a richer story, a more detailed story. Unless the car is terrible, I can't help but thinking that is going to give people a better impression of that car. And so, you know, to an extent, maybe that does make a difference. I really, really, really don't think that the quality of the hotel, or the food, or the amount of, you know, genuflecting that goes on, would make any kind of difference at all to anyone who could hold their head up high and say, I'm a proper motoring journalist. But clearly, the car manufacturers take a different view. They must have some kind of belief, or maybe they just do it because they feel that whatever they do, they are representing their brand. So,
yeah,
you know, it would be difficult for Rolls-Royce to do a launch out of a Premier Inn. Yeah. I think Premier Inns are fantastic. You know, they're exactly what I want. They have air conditioning that works. They have comfortable beds and they've got Wi-Fi. Okay. I understand why Rolls-Royce would never, ever launch a car out of a Premier Inn. But, you know, it's because, you know, they everything they do has to represent their brand. So if you go on a Rolls-Royce launch, you are going to end up in a very nice launch. But if you're going on a launch of a car where that's, you know, that's not such an issue, then I suppose, you know, I guess there will be just journalists who don't appreciate that. But I would so much rather stay somewhere quite modest if it meant that I could spend more time driving the car and driving the car on roads that help me understand that car better.
Yeah. Okay, last thing then on this topic that I want to raise. So very often, actually almost entirely is the case, when you go on these events, you share a car with another journalist. Hopefully someone you know, hopefully someone you like and get on with and trust.
Yeah.
But often it's someone you've never met, and you might be in the car for 6 hours or more with them, and that really puts your conversational energies and abilities to the test, doesn't it? But we've all shared cars with drivers who made us anxious.
Yeah.
I mean, that is a fairly terrible position to find yourself in when you think that every corner you're going to have a crash. That's awful, isn't it?
Well, it has happened. You know, one of my oldest, bestest friends in this business is a tetraplegic, and he was made that way because the person who he was driving, who was driving him, wouldn't slow down.
Yeah.
And this happened, I think, in 1989. And there was an accident. The driver walked away. And my friend has not been, you know, had the quality of life he might reasonably have, you know, had a right to expect. So, you know, it does happen.
And it is serious,
you know, I am so, you know, even if there's a, you know, I'm being driven by a perfectly safe driver, I'm such a terrible passenger. Literally, the first thing I do, if I know I'm going on a launch, you know, the invitation comes in, will you come here and drive that, is I ring up the manufacturer and I go, who else is going? And then, you know, I'll get a list of journalists' names, and then I'll go, okay, fine, well, I'll share with him. And, you know, Andrew English, one of TI's most esteemed contributors, is one of the first people I'll ring, because, you know, you could drive to the moon and back and he'd never put a wheel wrong. Mm-hmm. And also, he's great comfortable, the great company, he's an old buddy and we get on terribly well. But number one is he safe?
Yeah.
And is he going to be considerate? Because actually, you can be with some drivers who are really, really, really good drivers.
Yeah.
But they still go screaming around public roads at speeds you just don't think is appropriate. Even though they might be completely safe, you know, perhaps they're not considering the effect, you know, that seeing some supercar appearing sideways out of a corner might have on some, you know, unsuspecting other road user. And that makes me nervous and uncomfortable. And, you know, because I hate so much the idea of someone sitting next to me and me making them feel nervous and uncomfortable, I will only team up with people that I know are going to be are fine, because it's just awful.
Just for some balance, it does happen occasionally that you find yourself with a very experienced driver, skillful, but with, you know, enough caution, and they are knowledgeable, and having a conversation with them as you drive and as they drive and sharing your impressions together really helps. It helps you build a fuller picture of the car. So that is that's a very important component of a press launch, is who you find yourself sharing a car with. It can go either way. Good. Well, the press launches, as we said, it would be indulgent, and it was, so don't at us. Okay, well, thanks for listening, everybody. Please remember to rate and review the podcast. You're doing it and it's really helping, but don't stop. Keep going. Go and check out The Intercooler, the-intercooler.com. If you haven't already, you can start your free trial. Every Last Blast podcast is on there waiting for you. Our daily articles are waiting there for you. There are literally hundreds or more articles waiting, a million words ready, waiting for you to go and read them. And you get access to every single one of them if you subscribe today. But let's end this podcast with a listener question, which comes from Michael T.
I always forget you're going to do this. Sorry, it comes from who? Michael T.
Michael T. And it's a long question, but I'm going to summarise it. Is it worth paying top money for branded tyres? And I just want to give you, I've looked into this a little bit, I just want to give you an example. And this is for my car, my Golf. I'm looking at a website, and I could spend £122 on a Michelin Pilot Sport 5. That's the most expensive tyre I'm seeing. However, you know, there's a load of budget stuff for 70-odd quid, but I can see a Bridgestone for 90. I can see a Yokohama for 90, a Toyo for 90, a Dunlop for 95. You know, there are brand names here for significantly less than the most expensive Michelin or Pirelli.
Yeah.
Should I spend another 30 quid a corner? Another 120 quid in all on a brand?
Okay. Attack? Well, no, I think you probably shouldn't. I mean, you know, I'm sure like you, I have done many, many tyre tests, you know, proper tyre tests with instrumentation, with objective and subjective components on a range of different surfaces over the years. And I've tested conventional sort of everyday road tyres and track day tyres and all this sort of stuff. So I have in my head built up a, you know, an idea of whether, you know, it makes sense to spend the extra. And, you know, do I think it's worth spending another 30 quid a corner to get a Michelin over a Continental? Now, obviously, tyres vary from, you know, from car to car and from tyre to tyre, but generally speaking, no, I wouldn't. However, do I think it is worthwhile spending money on getting a decent tyre from a decent manufacturer? 100% I do. You know, tyres tend to sort of split into three categories. They're the sort of, there's the absolute bargain basement budget stuff. I'm not talking about remolds and that sort of thing, but just, you know, real, you know, bargain budget tyres. There's a lot of mid-range stuff, which is good. And then there is the top of the range stuff, which are from most of the manufacturers that most people are likely to have heard of. But funnily enough, I had exactly this. We have a family Golf, which we just use for knocking about, and it's 5 years old, and its tyres needed replacing very recently. And I had exactly this, you know, and you know, this exact thought process. Do I go for a sort of mid-range tyre, which I could have done very, very easily? And I just thought, you know, the thing about a tyre is it's what connects the car to the ground, yeah? It's the, in terms of the safety of you and your family, and do I really want to save 15 quid a corner, you know, and to even any extent compromise the safety of my wife, my children, anybody else who might be in it? Or do I just want, you know, the best I can afford? So I put a set of Continentals on it because, you know, that peace of mind, that you really have got the best tyre on the car that, you know, that you can get, is worth more to me than, you know, a few quid a corner. So, you know, I always would. You know, we've got a Toyota Aygo here. That's on Continentals too. It's probably the best shot Aygo in the world. But, you know, that's the car my children learnt to drive on. I'm not going to compromise on that. It's like, you know, if you race, it's like buying a cheap helmet. Why would you? You know, if you can't afford a decent helmet, don't race. Don't put your brain in something which isn't going to protect it properly. You know, don't put your children in something which aren't going to protect them properly. So, yeah, I would definitely shop around among the premium brands. And, you know, there might be, you know, some manufacturers in the sort of middle order thing which are thinking, well, this is all very unfair because actually all they're buying is a name and our tyres are just as good as theirs and I haven't tested everything. So, you know, maybe that's the case. But I don't know. Or what I do know is that if you go and buy a tyre from, you know, from Continental, from Pirelli, from Goodyear, from Dunlop, you're going to get a good tyre. And do you really want your family, your friends, your children to have anything else underneath them, connecting them to the road? I don't.
There you go. Michael, thank you. I think the answer is yes. So thanks for your question. Get your questions across and we'll end the podcast with another next week.
Thanks.
Hi, Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.